welcome to Gin Topic. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Anya. And it's Friday at 5 o'clock.
Oh, time for gin.
Yay!
We're going to drink a gin with our guests and enjoy this week's topic.
Yay! Cheers.
Cheers. Hey, Anya.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm okay. The sun's out and I'm going to drink gin.
Well, there you go. Who needs anything else?
How are you?
Exactly that. Sun's out. Gin is at the ready. So Excellent. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. So cool. We're going to drink gin. And of course, we're going to drink gin with Emma. We're going to taste it with our guest. Our guest this week is Genoveva Esteban.
Oh, brilliant name. Up there with the best.
And actually, she's a doctor, Genoveva Esteban. And in fact, as well as being a doctor, she's Professor Genoveva Esteban.
Oh, yes, Genoveva.
Genoveva is a professor of microbial ecology at Bournemouth University. As I was saying it, I was looking at it and going, microbial? What is microbial? Microbial. Yeah, yeah. Microbial.
Got it.
Yeah.
Microbial.
That's what it is. See.
Micro, of course, meaning very, very small.
Yeah. Bile. Beal. meaning. Loving the nose.
Little squished up nose.
Ah.
Okay.
So we are talking to Genoveva about microbes.
Oh, I know something about them.
Well, our question is, what are they? And why are they interesting?
That's a better question. I've got nothing there.
Oh, good. So we can answer that for you.
Good.
If you haven't listened to this week's tasting room yet, we've already spent a little time chatting with our guest and with our gin expert, Emma, finding out all about this week's gin, why our guest has chosen it, what it tastes like, and whether we like it or not. And this week, we're drinking Hendrick's. So don't forget to listen to our tasting room. But now, on with the topic. So this little bit, you get to sit back and enjoy the gin you've made.
Okay.
Anya and I,
relax for a moment.
Having had a few sips, we will resist drinking too much more until we have relieved ourselves of all of our knowledge on microbes.
Mm. Well, I can't wait to see how much you know about microbes.
Please don't get your hopes up. Please.
Okay, so Anya, microbes.
Yeah.
What are they and why are they interesting? What you got?
Well, I have one science GCSE and I did triple science. So this is clearly my area of expertise.
I'll just sit back and drink them.
Microbes, small things in cells is pretty much what I've got there.
Oh, added in cells. Yeah. I was getting small things, microbes. As you can see them down a microscope.
I think they're in cells. They might not be in cells, but I feel like they're in cells. I feel like there's something there. Maybe I'm lying. I feel like I'm dragging up memories from a long
feel
time
like
ago
we
that
should,
might not be real.
I feel like we should turn off Genoveva's camera because I can see Anya looking going, are they in? And they might be. You're not allowed to check whether you got it right, Anya? Not at all.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
That's the thing, isn't it? Microbes is a word. It's a word that we know. It's a word that's around.
Yeah, it's
and it's
thing.
Small things. I think, we know the small bit. We know the microscopes using small bit. What they are, I'm thinking they could be anything. They could be germs. They could be bits of dust. Maybe not bits of dust. But, they're just lots of tiny things. Why are they interesting?
I feel like it's a word we hear and we just go, yeah, sure, I know what that means. Even when we don't, and we just assume that we do, we go, yeah, yeah, sure, absolutely. You know, it's like when people try and explain taxes to me. I'm like, yeah, I totally get what you're on about. I don't, yeah. But I'm saying I do.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Why they're important, I've got nothing. I'm sure they're really important. I believe I'm going to learn why they are, but I don't know anything about why.
And not just important, but interesting. So I'm thinking, because microbes are small, there must be tons of them. And I'm imagining that this is going to be one of those existential crisis kind of episodes where you suddenly realise that you are surrounded by lots of stuff that you've never really thought of before.
Excellent. I love when we have those episodes.
So I think we've established that we have a lot to learn from in this episode, Genevieve. And I'm sure that at some point one of us is going to go, eek. One of us might have a bit of a crisis. We might end up crying into our gin, worried about all the stuff that around us.
Or you will love it.
Absolutely, we might. Yeah. They might be our best friends. Mm-hmm. So okay. We've got lots.
Is there anything in that?
What you have said is all correct. So,
oh, good.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, no, it is. I'm really impressed. So, yes, you can find microbes inside cells. Those, yes.
Yay!
Yeah, I mean, think of COVID, for example. You know, the SARS virus. Yeah, I mean, it, without cells, it wouldn't exist. So it needs to get into the cells to replicate itself. But other microbes don't need cells at all. Those are the ones that are called the free-living microbes. So they just live in the environment.
It sounds like something from the 60s. Yeah. We're free-living microbes.
Yeah, it's true. But that's what they do. They are free in the environment. You go to a river, you collect some water, as I did when I discovered the mint in the gin and tonic. And then you put some drops on under the microscope and you will see loads of microbes, from bacteria to fungi, microscopic plants, microscopic animals, all in one single drop. It really is very impressive.
Okay, so I think we need to start right at the beginning then, because what is then a microbe? Because, of course, you're then saying about microbes, fungi, bacteria, and all of these things. So what actually makes it a microbe?
So a microbe depends who you talked to, but if you talk to me, like is the case now, of course. So there are two main types of microbes. The ones that are that have a proper nucleus in the cell with the DNA, like ourselves, we do. Mm-hmm. And so those are known as the eukaryotic microbes. So they have a proper nucleus, eukaryotic microbes. And then you've got all the ones that don't have that nucleus in the cell, which are all the bacteria, and another group that is similar in shape to the bacteria is known as the archaea. In the past, they were called the archaea bacteria. So those are, these bacteria don't have any nucleus in the cell. They have the cell and the DNA inside, and that's it. And all these microorganisms, whether they have a nucleus or not, they are single-celled. So there is just one cell. Yeah. So if you imagine our body, we've got, I don't know, no one agrees how many cells we've got, but maybe 3 billion. 3 billion cells. So you took just one, that is what a microbe is.
Okay.
So and they have to find the food, they have to have sex, they have to reproduce as well, and then keep going. And they've been around well before we were on the planet. So yeah, very and as you say, they have astronomical abundance. It is difficult to imagine how many there are, because there are so many.
So if they sort of formed an army and rose up against us, we'd have no chance
at all. Yeah, well, that's
perfect.
That's
good.
I love that's where you've gone straight away.
it makes sense.
Exactly. No chance at all. Yeah. So they are, but that's what microorganisms are. So basically two types, the bacteria and that kind, and then the ones that have a proper nucleus like our cells. But all of them, just one single cell. Some of them are parasites, so they need to live inside the cells. And others just live free living in the environment, lakes, water, in the sand, in the pond, in the water bath, in the garden, whatever. Yeah. And some of these unicellular organisms are closely related to plants. So they are microscopic plants. Others behave more like animals. So there are the protozoa. I don't know if you remember from school, like the amoeba or paramecium or some of those.
Oh, amoeba. I remember the amoeba.
Yeah, well, those. Yeah. So those are the kind of creatures that I do for my research. Yeah.
Okay, so because you've got so many types, do you focus particularly on a set type?
Yes, I focus on the ones that are called the ciliates, which are, in a way, related to the amoeba.
Mm-hmm.
So they are single-celled, also with a proper nucleus in the cell. But then they have the cell is completely covered with tiny little hairs. They are not hairs, but it's called cilia. We've got cilia in our tummy, for example, or in our lungs as well. But these cilia, they're used just to swim in the environment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and these ciliates, they are called because they have the cilia. They also have a proper mouth. Believe it or not, it's just one cell, and they have a proper mouth, so they eat bacteria. And what they do, they clean the water out of bacteria. So they are really good for the environment. So the rivers, for example, they get clean out of bacteria because of these protozoa feeding on them or these ciliates. If you go to a sewage treatment plant, for example, they wouldn't work if it wasn't for these microorganisms because they feed on the bacteria that clean the sewage.
Mm. Okay, so I'm now thinking these are like a life, alien life form in itself. I've got a fabulous image of these little hairy things.
Yes, yeah.
And so,
With mouths.
They've got these little mouths. And so I'm imagining that I could, go down to my little pool of water because it's been raining and just scoop. If I just scoop stuff up and put it under a microscope, would I see them?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you would.
That's pretty cool.
And got to ask, it's not a question that's really got scientific merit, but when you say a mouth, do they have like teeth? Like, how is their mouth a mouth?
That's a brilliant question. Yes, some of them have, depends on the type of food that they eat. I know it sounds strange because they are single-celled, but still, they specialize in feeding on different types of microbes themselves. So some of them, for example, they have this mouth, which is like a little round opening, and they have like tiny little teeth inside. And what they do, they grab a filament, like an algal filament, and they suck it into the body.
Exactly, like spaghetti.
That's what I was going to say. Exactly the same, yeah. Yeah, and then because these filaments are much, much longer than the actual ciliate eating it, so with little teeth, they just bite through, if you like, and then they break this filament, and that's it.
Like when you've got too much pasta in your mouth and you have to bite it because you can't fit the rest in.
Yeah, that's what they do. Exactly the same. It really is. Whoa. When I explain this to my students, I always say it's like sucking up a spaghetti. Exactly the same. Yeah. It's just fascinating.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm trying to get this because you were saying that they are just one cell. So if we're thinking about an animal or a human as we would normally think about them as me with a mouth eating spaghetti, that's a lot of cells all talking to each other.
Yep.
And a brain and, nervous system and everything else in order to eat that spaghetti. But this is just a single cell thing.
That's it, yeah. So when they eat this filament or whatever they eat, the bacteria, whatever. So at the they have the mouth, and then at the bottom of that mouth, imagine a funnel, right? Mm-hmm. So the wider part of the funnel would be the mouth, the opening of the mouth, and then it goes down, the bacteria would go, or the filament would go down the funnel. At the end of that funnel, the narrower bit of the funnel, they form like a kind of bag, like a little, it's known as a vacuole, food vacuole. It's like a little bag, which is full of enzymes that will digest those bacteria or the filaments or whatever they eat. Sometimes they eat even microscopic animals, because the microscopic animals may be smaller than the actual single celled organism. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so do microbes eat microbes?
Yes, they have to eat something that is smaller than them, because they are
not in a cannibal way. In a we eat different microbes, so we're not.
Oh
cannibals.
No, some of them are cannibals.
But as long as it's smaller they can fit it in.
They're tiny
things with tiny teeth sucking up spaghetti, but the spaghetti is the same as them, so it's a spaghetti cannibal situation.
Yeah, some of them do eat each other, yeah. When there is some kind of vitamins lacking in the environment, then they just eat each other, which is rather sad, but I've seen it many times, yeah.
Needs must, I guess.
Yes.
Yes, they're not necessarily choice cannibalism.
No.
But out of necessity.
Yes.
Which, you know, if we get into the whole, if you were the only two people on the earth, would you eat each other's fingers?
Yes, well, maybe
we'll share. I love that you've gone there, Sarah. Moving swiftly on. How long does a microbe live for?
Well, that's a very good question again. So, you could say that they live forever.
Oh, hold on, they're cannibals that live forever.
So, the way these microbes reproduce, they just split in two. So you've got one cell, they will divide in two, the mother and the daughter cell, and then they split, and then they will divide in two again, and so forth. So they can go on forever. Yeah? So that's the way it is.
And so do they is it just a cycle that it you know, it feels like the right time to divide yourself to reproduce?
Yeah, if there is enough food it's the right temperature in the water, because they need water for survival.
There's no fertilization involved. There's plenty. There's too much food here for me. I'll produce another me.
Yes, exactly. And many more copies of yourself. Yes, yeah. That's the way it is. I mean, some of them do have sex. So if there is a sudden change in the environment, for example, say I collect water sample in the river, and then I take it to the lab where it would be warmer in the lab than in the river, if it is, say, winter, then that change in temperature may trigger these organisms to go to have sex. And so what they do, you see them under the microscope, you've got the two cells, they join the mouth and then they swim together for a while. Aww. And then through the mouth, they carry out an exchange of the DNA, the genetic material, and once they do that, then they separate and then they swim. They just go their own lives, and that's it. Yeah, it's not easy to see, but it is quite common. Yeah.
And are they sharing DNA for reproduction or just for pleasure?
Well, I don't know if there is any pleasure involved. No idea. but yeah, it's for reproduction. Yeah, it's just to refresh all the genetic material that they have. Yeah.
And so would that happen normally as well, as you said? So that, you know, that could be because of the temperature change, as you said, to going from collecting them in the winter into the lab, and it gets all warm, and they go, ha ha, let's get jiggy with it because it's springtime and it's all warm. Would that naturally happen?
Oh, yes.
As it gets warmer?
Oh, yes.
It's not a sudden change that makes
them suddenly think, oh my God, we've only got minutes to live, let's go for it.
Yeah, no, the sudden change is what triggers it. But it could be, yeah. It could be. I mean, I don't know, the increase in daylight, for example, you know, the length of the daylight, or usually related to the temperature, but sometimes it's also related to the amount of food that is available. So yes, they take that opportunity to just flourish, and then before that source disappears. So they try to increase the size of their populations, the abundance of the population, just to take advantage of those environmental conditions. Yeah.
Is it then certain microbes that would do that and others just cell divide? Or is it that they do it in order to make it quicker? That suddenly there's an abundance of food, or it suddenly got really warm, that let's quickly have sex because then we can produce more quickly rather than just dividing into two.
Yeah, gosh, you do really, you make very quick questions. I'm very impressed.
I'm honestly one of the first times somebody said that.
I'm imagining my life as a microbe, you know. I'm like, when would I do this?
I would like to have that just as a review, because normally people don't comment on our questions, so it's quite nice to hear that.
It is. I'm impressed. I'm impressed. So it could be the most common way of reproducing is just by splitting into the binary division. Mm. Yeah, that is quick. The other one, it is true that what you say, that you say, okay, well, there is this change, this favorable change in the environment, let's take advantage and let's refresh the population, if you like, by exchanging the genetic material. So yes, is it quicker? Maybe not, but it could be quicker, I guess. It's more, I guess, than anything else, because it's not much known. Once they exchange the genetic material, then they go into the cell division again, so that the whole process may be longer than the actual cell division, but it certainly is just to take advantage of the favorable environment. Yes,
and we know that if there's not enough of them, that can be damaging. If there's suddenly loads due to a good change, and then something happens where those things stop happening,
that's when they eat each other.
Is that the only thing that happens, that they eat each other, or does it also impact the environment that
it can affect the environment. So if you think, for example, in the summer, when the temperatures go up, and sometimes you read in the newspapers, or you hear on the news that a dog is going to drink water from a lake and is died. That is because of one type.
That's the green blue algae.
Exactly. The cyanobacteria.
Which I have to watch out for with the dogs.
Yes, yeah.
And you can't go swimming in the lakes with the green blue algae because it's really dangerous.
Yeah.
So they're microbes, are they?
Yeah, they are microbes, and it's a type of bacteria, and they can produce toxins. So is the toxin what kills, you know, the animals when they go, or ourselves if we drink that water? So it's quite dangerous. So yes, it can affect the environment, and the same happens in the sea, for example, with the red tides, which are it's a type of marine alga that they grow when, again, it depends on the amount of nutrients in the sea, the temperature, also with the light. So it's several factors. And they can produce these red tides. The sea goes red in color.
Wow.
And again, they can be very toxic. So they can completely wipe out, say, if you have oyster farms or clams farms or shrimps, because those animals feed on these microscopic algae, and they are toxic. And the thing is that the toxins can accumulate inside the animals, inside the shrimps or the clams, and if we eat those intoxicated animals, then that can go into our system as well. And they are saying that sometimes of dementia may come from the toxins of these microscopic algae that grow in the sea. So they are looking into that as well.
So, sorry, dementia comes from?
Yeah. They are saying that some of the toxins, because they can accumulate in the animals that feed on those algae, yeah, like oysters or clams, yeah, or shrimps and mussels, for example, yeah, then the toxin that comes from the algae can accumulate inside these mussels or oysters or whatever. And then if we eat those mussels with a toxin, then that can accumulate in
that
our
brains.
That
will accumulate within us.
So if you then have the dementia gene, stay away from mussels.
Exactly.
Just in case.
Yep.
No, I love mussels. I love mussels.
Well, I mean,
I don't love mussels.
I do love mussels, but I mean, they should be fine. The ones that get to the market should be perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And so then do we have also those kinds of events with the, like the blue-green algae last year was really bad because of the heat waves that we had. Mm-hmm. And so is that also the case that then with the Red Sea,
Red tides.
The red tides.
You're thinking of Moses there, Sarah. You're on about parting the Red Sea and Moses doing his whole thing.
But is that then becoming more common to because of the extremes?
It is becoming more common because of the higher temperatures as well, and also for longer time as well, and also the amount of nutrients or in the form of nitrates, for example, the runoff from agricultural lands and also from wastewater that ends up in the sea. So all those are nutrients for the algae, really. So they have nitrogen and phosphorus, then they love it. Mm. So, yes, and, you know, higher temperatures, then just it's the ideal.
May you all get jiggy with it.
Yeah, why not? Let's go. I mean, they grow, of course. Why not?
Yeah.
So really it's very important to have the right balance in the amount of them, because if there's too many, it's a bad thing. If there's too few, it's a bad thing. Mm. They're super important.
So we were talking about these red tides and sort of blue-green algae where they've got to the point where actually they're causing the problem. But going back a little while, you were talking about how important they are in sewage treatments.
Yep.
So they obviously do really good cleaning stuff, as well as then getting a bit too into it to reproduce themselves too much to cause the problem.
Yeah, it's different types of microorganisms, the ones that grow in one place and another. But for the sewage, definitely, they are essential for cleaning the sewage. Yeah, without that, it wouldn't be cleaned.
Is it just a process of they're basically eating the sewage and then it comes out clean the other end, you know?
No, what they do is mainly, so the bacteria can take all the organics that are dissolved in the water, without going into much detail, but if you imagine all the organics that are in the sewage, so the bacteria can they can take that in.
Yeah, let's not say anything that's going to put anyone right off their gym.
Exactly. Yeah, but the bacteria can take that in. And then you've got the other bigger organisms, like the ciliates and all these protozoa, that eat the bacteria. So by feeding on the bacteria, you create there like a food chain, if you like, and they control. If there were too many bacteria in the sewage and nothing controlling them, they would eventually die because they would consume all the oxygen in the water, and they wouldn't be cleaning any sewage at all. Whereas you just have something controlling the numbers, like these ciliates that eat them, then you keep those populations very fresh, if you like, and those are the bacteria, the ones that are going to take all those organics from the water. So what the other guys are going to do is just, it's not that the water goes in and comes out clean, it's that the bacteria take all those organics and they form more bacteria, because for them it's the food. So they form more bacteria, and the other guys are just controlling their numbers. So it forms like a little network there, all working together. And then what you end up with is with water that has less organics in it, because it's all been consumed. And the water is clean. It's cleaner. I take my students to a sewage treatment plant every year. and
you know how to show them a good time.
Yeah, and they all complain, you know, because that's the smell. And I say, well, if you go to a fish shop, it smells. If you go to, you know, it smells. So it's the same with sewage. Mm. You go to a sewage plant, it does smell of something, yeah. But it's not that bad. And then we always examine, you know, some drops of this biological process under the microscope, and they can't believe how much is growing there. It's just, it's really fascinating. Mm. It's just, yeah.
And so slightly off topic, but I always love to know when we chat to people who study these really amazing things, what made you decide to go into this field and go, I want to look at these microbes?
Well, I was at uni, and so at the time I was doing biological sciences in Madrid, and at the time it was the degree was lasted 5 years, and on my third year I just chose microbiology, but it was mainly bacteria, and I thought, oh, I'd really like this. So I went to talk to the head of the department, and I said, well, I would like to do something else, you know, some research or some master's by research or something. I still had two years to go, but I was really interested. Mm. And he said, well, why bacteria and not protozoa? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know.
Sometimes it chooses you.
And then he said, well, I'm going to give you a book. So he gave me a book on these other larger microbes, which I read over the summer. And then I looked at some samples under the microscope and said, I can't believe this. You know, it was like, you think of bird watchers, you know, the tuchers that go out with their binoculars. It was the same, but looking at the microscope, the amount of things that I could see moving around, I said, yes, yeah, I'll do something on this. And then, yeah, and that was it, yeah. Brilliant. And then I did, I saw an advert on a newspaper to do a PhD research council in Spain, and I could choose the topic. And at the time, I was very much into birds because I really, really like birds. And I had already done my master's by research on microbes. But I thought, well, I have the choice now to go back to birds and leave the microbes for good. But then I thought, well, who is going to feed me, the microbes or the birds? And I thought, I think the microbes will give me a better chance. And then I chose the microbes, and yeah, the rest is history, really. Yeah, never looked back.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
And so like bird spotting, can you literally, like the sort of go to a pool and pick out things and put it under a microscope, can you then differentiate between all the microbes that would be in there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. Yeah, some of them, as I say, it's a bit like a garden, if you like. So you put your water sample there, and then you will see some that are green in color because they are more like plants, but they are part of the plant kingdom. So they are they photosynthesize and everything. So they are little green things on different shapes, different. Some of them form little groups, like colonies that we call them, or some of them are just, they swim around. But there are many, many, many types, yeah. And you can, and some of them are really interesting because they have like valves that are made of glass. So they are known as the diatoms. And these diatoms, they have like two valves. If you think of a shoebox with a lid on the bottom, and you imagine that in glass, made of glass, and then you reduce it to microscopic level, yeah, really tiny, that would be this kind of algae, the diatoms. They are made of glass, so silicon.
How?
They just take it from the environment, and then they produce these, and they are amazing. I mean, if you Google diatoms, and they are really incredible.
It's like the Cinderella's slipper of microbes.
I love that.
You can use that one for free.
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, that's really clever. Yes, yeah, they are amazing. And the good thing as well is that when they perish, these diatoms perish, you can find them in the sea, in fresh water as well. But when they perish, because they are made of glass, then they will enter the fossil record.
So super tiny fossil.
Tiny, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but because there are so many of them, when they perish, they just go to the bottom of the sea or the lake or whatever, and they will form like layers, if you like, all fossilized, obviously, after thousands of millions of years. And so if you go back and collect samples from, say, 10,000 years ago, and you look at the fossilized diatoms of these little glass houses, so you can reconstruct past environments by looking at the different types of these glass houses. And then you can compare.
Man, microbes are so fucking cool.
Yeah, and then you can compare those environments to the ones now. You can see how they have, that certain habitat has changed over, I don't know, 10,000 years maybe. It really is fascinating.
And tracking that through something really small, you know, when we think about fossils, you know, we just think dinosaurs, big things, ammonites, you know, these stone-type things, but like tiny, tiny microbial glass slippers at the bottom of an ocean.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah, wow. It's fascinating, yeah. But if you, it's the same with the white cliffs of Dover, you know, or here in Dorset, those are all made by microorganisms. So you take a little sample, or chalk, if you think of chalk, the one that we use, in, and you take a sample from the chalk or from the cliff, the white cliff, and you put it under the microscope, especially if it is a scanning electron microscope, which can give you very, very high magnification. You can see the individual microbes there, all fossilized.
So if you're drawing with chalk, you're drawing with dead microbes.
Fossilized microbes, yeah.
I'm feeling quite emotional about these little microbes. You wouldn't just pick up a dinosaur piece and start drawing on the chalkboard with it, you know. I mean, it wouldn't draw on the chalkboard, but people would have a go at you. They'd be like, you know, stop with the T-Rex toe, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can't see them, so if you don't see them, you know.
So talking about don't see them, can't see them. So I'm sat here. We're all sat here.
Oh, you're
going to
do the existential breakdown thing now. I can feel it. Here we go.
Okay. How many microbes are around me now?
How many? I think it's impossible to say. I mean, if you think of our homes, what we do every day is to kill microbes. Whenever we wipe them, we clean the bathroom or we clean a surface. What we are doing is basically clean, just kill
That's
all the
such
microbes.
A good excuse to not clean my flat this weekend. I'll be like, no, I'm preserving the microbes.
Yes, I'm looking after nature.
And okay, so that's one of the things I've always been totally against, using antibacterial cleaning products.
Oh my god, no, I'm like, you don't understand. When she says she's so against it, honestly, it's like if I came home with a bottle of bleach at any point, I would have been chucked out the house.
And
like,
as a child, you were sent outside to play in the dirt because it's good. Yeah. It's good.
Well, it is good. Oh, within limits, obviously. I mean, there are some microbes that are nasty.
Well, okay, so I'm going to say can we split these microbes out? Are there the good camp microbes and the bad microbes?
Yeah, there are. But the thing is that the ones around you will be a mixture of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So at home, you just don't know what you are going to find.
I need a little bird spotter's book here for microbes now. Looking at you. What are you? Are you good? Are you bad? I kill you, but I save you.
Yeah, so there will be, I don't have an answer, I don't know how many millions of microbes there will be in any home, never mind how clean it is. Yeah, there will be lots,
And on us as humans and in as humans?
Oh, yeah, our skin, our mouth. I mean, if you think of when a baby is born after a few hours of being in this world, then it will have the typical bacteria that grow in your mouth. They will be there, yeah. But they are harmless. They are part of what we are. I mean, if you think of our tummies, you know, our stomach will have millions of bacteria.
Yeah, because that became a real trend a few years ago, was like yogurt drinks that were good for your gut microbiome type thing.
Yes, again, it's one of those words, isn't it? It becomes part of advertising. It's like your gut microbiome, and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, feed my gut. It's like, actually, what is it? We're talking about these little microbes live.
But it is, I mean, there's a lot of marketing in it, of course. But your gut microbes are very good because they are producing vitamins that we otherwise wouldn't be able to produce ourselves. And they produce also what is known as amino acids, which are nutrients for our cells as well. So if we wouldn't have them, then we would have to take them in somehow. Because they can't, these vitamins cannot be found in food, for example. So it's just the actual microbes that use the food that we eat just to produce these. For them, it's a waste product, which is the vitamins, and that is what benefits us. So yes, they are good for us. Yeah,
I love that. Wow. It's just live off their waste.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's, in a way, it's like the plants or these microscopic algae when they photosynthesize and they produce oxygen, which I'm sure you have heard of it. So that oxygen is just a waste. That's a waste product of the of the photosynthesis. It just so happens that
it's quite handy.
Yeah, it's just handy for many of us, for most life on Earth. Yeah, that's how life evolved and became more complex because there was oxygen. So, and this oxygen was produced by the blue-green algae and by the plants, and that oxygen accumulates in the atmosphere because of the particular characteristics of the Earth's atmosphere. Mm. If we were on Mars and you've got all this algae growing there, all that oxygen would go straight into the space because there is nothing to retain them there. Yeah. Whereas here we've got the atmosphere, so the oxygen stays in here. That's the problem with global warming, that the CO2 is staying there. Mm.
So are there microbes in space?
In space... I don't really know. I don't think so, because they wouldn't survive because of the radiation. They wouldn't survive.
But there must be microbes on spaceships and in, you know, space stations, because you got people in them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there will be. Yeah, whether the microbes will survive in that environment with such high levels of radiation.
Am I hearing that somebody needs to go to space to look at microbes
collect,
in space?
Collect some samples and bring them back.
Yeah, somebody needs to do that. Someone can make that their PhD project. Yeah. Go crazy, guys.
Yeah, it's not a cheap way of collecting the samples, but yes.
Okay, wow. So from all of the different microbes, what's your favourite?
The ciliates. Yeah, the ones with the mouth.
Okay, why?
Yeah, I think they're my favourite.
Because they've got little mouths.
The ones with the mouth, yeah, because there are so many of them, and so the diversity is incredible. I mean, you wouldn't believe what one cell can look like. Some of them have tentacles, and they can extend these tentacles to catch the prey, and then they retract them again. And it's just one cell. It really is incredible. Yeah, some of them know if they're up or they are down, so they can detect gravity.
And how do you know that? How can you find that out?
Because they have, this is just doing experiments in the lab, but these microbes, they have like little mineral particles inside. And you know when you move your mobile, that you turn it one way or another.
Yeah, and you have to put the auto lock rotation on to stop it from moving. Yeah,
yeah. So these microorganisms do the same. They have these mineral particles inside. And if they live in places which is dark, but not too dark, because they don't like the light, but they don't like too much darkness. And they also live in places where there is very little oxygen. So if for whatever reason they swim up, in the in the lake, for example, where they live. So if they swim up, there will be more oxygen because there's always more oxygen up in the surface. Yeah. And there's also more light, obviously. So that oxygen and the light will make those mineral particles inside the single cell organism to somehow vibrate, and that will make them just the mouth, the snout, just to go down, and then they swim
then
towards,
they go back down again.
Then where it is darker and it's less oxygen. And you can reproduce that in the lab. And that's how we know that it happens. Yeah. It's fascinating. Oh, wow. It's fascinating. I've got a former PhD student who was working on one of these organisms, the ones that no one did up or down, and in Florida, and he collected a sample and he had thousands of these particular organism. And what he did was to shine a light, you know, like a torch on them, and then all of them swam down as they were tricking them, and then again, and then would start swimming up again, and then shining the light again, and then all of them down again. It was
you can create like the murmurations that you see with birds.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
With different light show on the microbes.
See, you were thinking of that. I was thinking of that scene in Nemo where all the fish move themselves to form things.
It's fascinating. And it's just one cell. It's incredible. It really is incredible. Yeah.
There's so much stored in a single cell. Like, we always think of single cells as something that, you know, it's maybe a bit primitive and there's not much in them, but there's so much information there.
It's incredible. Yeah. And with all the new molecular tools to investigate them, the way they have found out a lot about how they originated, how the whole of the evolution within these single cell organisms has happened, and it's a completely new
Because you said at the beginning they've been around since before humans.
They've
been around forever.
And then we go back to when you mentioned about the amoeba and the fact that you only really learn that in school as a process of evolution, and it's just it was a thing, single cell. Really dull.
Okay, that's how you learned about it. I learned about it with kids going around the corridors for about 3 weeks going, amoeba.
But that it being just a really dull single cell, it doesn't do anything. It's just a single cell.
It's just a blob. The amoeba is just a blob that moves, But they are fascinating.
But what you're saying is that there are so many single cells that are more than just a blob.
Oh, yes, they look
with
mouths. Some
blobs
of them have
that
a mouth.
Up and down.
Yes.
Blobs with tentacles.
Blobs with tentacles.
Yes, got tentacles. Yeah, other
cannibal
look
blobs.
Like, some of them look like flowers. So they can contract all together and then they expand again and they look like flowers. It's just amazing variety of them. Yeah. It really is fascinating. I love it. Yeah.
And so going into the do you split them up then? Have you got like animal single cells, you know, and plant versions, and you mentioned fungi earlier as well, and you know, it do we distinguish between them all?
Some of them are part of the plants. So they are microscopic plants. They are exactly like plants. They have similar type of, well, the same type of photosynthesis, for example. Others are more complex, more related to the red algae, for example. So, but they are more, if you like, plant-like in general terms. And then others are more, traditionally, they have been considered more animal-like because they can eat other organisms like the ciliates I was referring to earlier. But they are not part of the animal kingdom at all, so they are completely separated from them.
And because if we're thinking about things like bacteria, we think of it as quite predatory. As you know, bacteria is out to get you. You know,
kills 99.9% of bacteria.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Well, but that's true. But you only need one bacterium left just to start. You know, the whole population. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter whether you have 99.9 or 98. You will never kill them all.
Oh, somebody put that on a Cillit Bang bottle right now.
So you just need one. Just to start the whole process again. It's Yeah, that's a lot of marketing in there. But yes, and then some of them, as you were saying, Sarah, are fungi, so the unicellular fungi, like the yeasts, which we use to produce the beer, for example, or for the baker's yeast, which is the same one. So they are, again, unicellular, and they are amazing because they can flick, you know, to one kind of metabolism or another, whether you give them oxygen or not. You remove the oxygen and then they produce the alcohol, so that we get the beer. But if you buy a cheap beer and you leave it outside, you know, in a glass for, I don't know, 2 or 3 days, then you will get different types of colonies, you know, floating there, different colours.
That's
the
different types of your own microbes.
Yeah, different types of yeast. It's really, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, the difference, because with the more expensive beer, they tried to use just one single type of yeast or strain so that they know what the end product is going to taste and look.
So if you're drinking your Stella versus your craft IPA...
Yeah, then I think, you leave it outside the fridge in a glass for a few days and then you will see all these little moldy things growing, which are all the yeast in different colours, yeah.
That's all the teenage boys in the world just going, yeah, that's why I'm leaving things in my glasses, Mum,
so I can study the
microbiomes.
At which point you just need to turn around and go, yeah, but where's your microscope? Because you can't see them.
Exactly. Yeah, you can see them.
If you're going to grow them, study them.
Okay, so is there anything that we really, really don't know about microbes? Like, it's just a giant mystery and we can't figure it out.
Well, there are microbes that we don't know anything about them yet, especially if there are environments that are difficult to get to, like, think of the deep sea, you know, 5,000 meters down there is quite difficult to get. I mean, you can collect samples, and I have examined that type of samples, but if there are environments that are difficult to sample, then we don't know much of what type of microorganisms live there. And if we go into the viruses, although viruses are not living organisms per se, they are considered particles, not living organisms. But as we sadly know through COVID, I mean, with viruses you can get anything and everything, and it's the same. You can find viruses in seawater, and they wipe out the algal populations, for example. You can also find them in freshwater. So they are virtually everywhere. Yeah, they are. So viruses, I think, is we don't know. We are just, scratching the surface. In a way, it's terrifying, really, with the viruses, yeah.
And as you were saying, in terms of the microbes in themselves, that we're still... Mm-hmm. understanding their function and their importance in the sort of system, from, you know, in the ocean and feeding mussels and then into our brains, all of that kind of thing. There must be so much more to study than birds.
Definitely. Yes, that's a very good point.
You made the right choice.
Yes, yeah, I think I did. Yeah, I never looked back. Yeah, no, and still, I can still do the birds anyway. No research, but I can see them. But it's not the same. Yeah, no. I never regretted it. No, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is a lot to learn about. And some of these microbes, despite the fact that there are, as I say, astronomical abundance of them, some of them are very, very, very rare. So they are very difficult to find because they are specialized in feeding on something that is rare in itself. And if all they eat is that, then it's quite difficult to find them. So some of them have...
Like pandas insisting on only eating bamboo, it makes them rare.
Exactly. Well, think of the equivalent in the microbial world. So it's very difficult to find them. So some of them haven't been found for maybe 100 years or something. And so those are the ones that we are targeting in our research now, trying to find all these very, very rare microbes and see what they do, what they look like, and try to get some photographs of them, try to do some molecular work on them as well, and then see how where they sit on the tree of life as well.
Yeah. So where are you hunting next?
Where am I hunting next? Well, next week I will go with two of my students to show them some of the ponds here in Dorset, because I haven't been to those particular ponds since before the first lockdown. So I wanted to see, I want to see what is happening there. And well, if the ponds are still there, my hope is that they're still there, because there were those ponds had really unusual microorganisms. So I wanted to, I will take them there and see what kind of microbes and symbiosis they have as well. So symbiosis is when two different types of microbes live together. It could be, you know, symbiosis in larger organisms as well. But in my case, I look at symbiosis between or consortia between different types of microbes. And those ponds used to have a really large diversity of these rare symbiosis. So I wanted to go there and see and see what is happening there.
Fingers crossed.
And then I've got collaboration with other people, like my current collaboration with my colleague in Poland as well, James Weiss, and he's also looking at very rare environments in the Warsaw area. And again, you know, he's finding really unusual and rare organisms. So we try to find the ones that haven't been found for a long time.
It's quite exciting. And you get to live every day inspiring the next generation as well.
I hope so.
By taking them to a sewage plant.
Yes, exactly. True. Yeah, but you really, you never know what you're going to find. And that's the thing. You know, I collect a sample from a pond, wherever the pond might be, and I sit at the microscope and I think, oh my gosh, what am I going to find? Am I going to have the time to follow it up if I find something unusual or rare or new? Sometimes it's a new species. Am I going to have the time? But it still is exciting after all these years since, you know, that third year at uni. It's a long time since then. But yeah, I love it. I really like it.
And you know what? You can feel that talking to you tonight. I'm inspired about microbes in a way I've never been before.
Oh, that's good.
Brilliant.
So you will never look at a pond in the same way again.
I really won't. I'm never going to look at anything the same way again. I'll be there like, sorry, guys, can we just stop taking cute photos for a minute? Because I'm just checking. This lake has some like blue-green algae here.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm going straight onto Google in a minute with the rest of my gin to have a look at these microbes, because, of course, you know, they're not anything that we've had a look at. I want to see the males. I'm desperate to see the males.
Yeah, they are. I mean, if you Google ciliates and people ciliate and mouth, you will get all kinds of images there.
Well, dear listener, that is your fun Friday night treat, or whatever night we put it out on. I can't even remember right now.
It is a fascinating world, because we don't see it, we don't realise, but it really is the dramas that go on in there. It's just incredible.
You could basically do a Keeping Up with the Kardashians episode, but with a bunch of microbes.
Yes. Yeah, true. Yeah, the way they eat each other, it's great,
Oh, we love them. Love them. Thank you so much for telling us about microbes. I haven't been icked out so much.
No.
I haven't had too much of an existential crisis.
I feel good.
I actually feel in love with the microbes. I'm like, yay, go. Love the idea of microbe hunting. It's just like, go find some amazing, unusual, rare things.
I think we should all grow microbe hunting together and then have a gin afterwards, and it would be a great time.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
I think pairing a gin with a microscope is just the
brilliant.
Best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really am chuffed. It's really, really nice just to talk to you. And thank you for the really interesting questions. Amazing. Thank you so much.
We will now let you go and drink the rest of your Hendrix. Well,
thank you to you.
And any of the microbes that are probably still on the mint leaves that are in your glass.
Yes. I can see something swimming around. I'm not sure.
All good for the gut microbiome.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Genevieve.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you.
Right, microbes. I wonder how many are in my cucumber and pepper. Do you reckon? Actually, they're probably
quite a few.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought I would say the sentence I'm about to say. Mm. If you had asked, you know, childhood me, who's in biology, if I'd ever thought I'd say this, she'd basically punch you. Mm-hmm. But microbes are fascinating.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I think it really helps when you've got somebody who's telling you about microbes that really love them.
Yes, yeah.
So I think it has a real difference in terms of learning about microbes, not as part of a curriculum, not as the process of evolution, amoeba little blob, but as just the, oh my God, how many different types of things there are and what amazing things
that
they
can
do.
And
just this single cell, you know, single cell with a mouth eating spaghetti or each other. Nom, nom, nom. I love the fact that I've actually got that on video. Might have to use that as a clip.
Oh, God. I forgot you were videoing this bit.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So the fact that they can do so much and like the knowing up and down, you know, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't consciously have that conscious awareness up and down.
And they choose how they want to reproduce. They choose whether they want to, you know, join
it's
mouths
warm.
Or whether
Let's
they want to
mouths.
Just cell divide.
Yeah, yeah.
They basically impact all of our environments, either for positive or for negative, depending on what's going on around them at the time.
Pretty much everything that we need to live on is waste products of microbiome.
Amazing.
Microbe.
Is there a lot of marketing involved in the whole good for your gut microbiome, kill all of this microbiome? Yes, but there is also some truth in the fact that those gut microbiome are really important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, because you have that whole ecosystem that people don't, you know, it's only been the recent thing that we've really understood about the environment of our gut and how important those microbes are, because as Genevieve was saying, you know, they're still only just finding out so much about it, and there's so much that they're hunting for. So of course there's always marketing bollocks, but it's still based in truth. But don't kill all bacteria.
Oh, here she goes. She's on her soapbox, people. Well, before Sarah gets all on her soapbox, I'm going to say thank you again to Genevieve, because that was a bloody brilliant lesson on
microbes.
I'm still not sure I know how to say it.
No, I know. This is the problem with gin. So I think because you've got
I will say, shout out to the Hendrix. I'm having a great time.
Loving Hendrix, loving it. Love little
Might
little
have to
microbes.
Have another one.
Oh dear. And then go and do a little bit of pond dipping and see what microbes you can find.
You know what? I actually think maybe, hear me out on this one. I want to drive 1 hour and 10 minutes to go and visit Pride and Prejudice filming location that's part of the National Trust, and they have a pond there, and I'm wondering if I examine the micro stuff in the pond.
You would need a microscope to do it, though. I'm thinking I might just go onto Google and just fall down a rabbit hole of microbe pictures and see the funny
little mouths.
Oh, you want to
go down the Wikipedia hole?
I'm going to fall down that hole and look at weird... And then I'm just going to spam you
do you
with
think
all
you're gonna
the weird and wonderful microbe... Yeah, probably. I'm off to do that now. That's going
to
be me for
lovely
the evening.
To see you.
With the rest of the bottle of Hendrix. Making a little
me
cocktail.
Too. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which, if you haven't yet listened to The Tasting Room,
listen to it. Oh, do, because Emma's given us a great recommendation for a cocktail, and I think it would pair perfectly with a little microscope work.
Oh, yeah. Nice. So if you're working at a microscope... grab a Hendrix. And on that note.
Nice. We're getting almost good at this.
Well, there you go. We finished the gin. That was this week's topic. Join us next week for another one.
Lovely. Where can people find us in the meantime, Sarah?
At Topic Gin. So find us on Twitter, find us on Instagram, find us on FaceTime? No? Facebook?
We're on Facebook?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
But we're not on TikTok.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Or you can head over to our website, ginandtopic.com, and you can email us, hello@ginandtopic.com.
And you can see us on Tuesday for the tasting room.
The next gin. Oh, can't wait.
See you then.
And see you next week for the next topic too.